Welcome to The Babblery, conversations where we explore the knowledge, opinions, passions, and obsessions of my guests. This is Suki Wessling, and today's program was recorded for Talk of the Bay on KSQD 90.7 FM, Santa Cruz, California. As a lover and writer of children's books, I think that books for kids are now and have always been about representation. Kids naturally see themselves in stories, and they naturally learn from stories. That's why the early stories for children were didactic and often awful. They were seen as a teaching tool. But even when they were meant mostly for entertainment, children learned from them. I know that I learned from Alice in Wonderland, for example. Written to entertain the real Alice by an educated and creative author, the book encouraged me to give everyday objects and creatures a second look and to explore the world with more curiosity and wonder. I really had nothing in common with Alice, but I saw myself in her struggles to make meaning out of an apparently meaningless world. These days, however, representation in children's literature has become a political hot topic. Adults of a variety of political persuasions believe that children shouldn't read about ideas they disapprove of. They rightly know that children learn from the books they read, but they are wrong to think that banning books will result in the ideas just disappearing from their kids' lives. Children who read fiction, not surprisingly, are more empathetic, both to others and to themselves. In this conversation, we talk about how kids need to see people like them represented, and they also need to see people very unlike themselves. Books don't change who kids are, but they do allow children a wider view of who people are. And some adults clearly find this a scary proposition. Welcome to Talk of the Bay, KSQD's local news program, brought to you every weekday at 5 p.m. I'm your host, Suki Wessling, and today I'm joined by three children's writers to talk about something that's been a hot topic in the children's book world lately, representation. The authors joining me write about children and subjects that don't necessarily represent any sort of average child, and yes, I'm putting air quotes in there. We've come a long way since the days of Dick and Jane. The idea behind representation in children's books is that all children need to see characters like themselves in children's fiction, and all children need to see characters who are unlike themselves represented as well. We'll talk about what representation means and how children's books have succeeded and failed at this goal in the past and present. This conversation was pre-recorded. Monica Wesselowska is the author of two children's picture books, her debut, Leo Plus Leah, and the forthcoming Albert in the Air, as well as the memoir, Holding Sylvan, A Brief Life. For the last 20 years, she's taught creative writing and worked as an independent editor. Welcome, Monica.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Sarah and Ian Hoffman are the authors of Jacob's New Dress, Jacob's Room to Choose, and Jacob's School Play, starring He, She, and They. Their books have won numerous awards, including the number 72 spot on the American Library Association's list of the top 100 most banned books of the decade. Congratulations on that one. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you, Suki. It's so good to be here with you.
And welcome, Ian.
Hi, Suki. Nice to be here.
So we're going to talk about representation, and I think a good place to start is one of the first questions that people always ask authors, which is, where did you get the idea for your book? And I also know that for all of you, the answer has to do with representation. So let's just start there. Monica, can you start us off and let us know about where you got the idea for Leo Plus Leah?
Sure. I got the idea for this book from a boy that I met in a classroom where I was volunteering to read, kindergarten classroom, who didn't want to sit for story time. He wanted to go into the corner and do math by himself. And I thought, wow, what would that feel like? And could I write a story that he might actually be intrigued by? So that was the seed of it. And I pondered it for a while. And one day I got this idea of writing a story based on a math pattern. I thought, I will have the words on the page follow this math pattern. And the pattern I chose was the Fibonacci sequence, which is a math pattern that has a lot of popular appeal, which I really liked, for its connection, largely for its connection to nature. But it's also a pattern that's fairly easy for kids to figure out, at least in the beginning, because it's very simple addition. And so I launched this story, had to start with one word on the first page and one word on the second and two words on the third. It was quite a challenge. But along the way, I had Leo just stick to his guns and keep counting. I really wanted to write a story where he wasn't taught to stop counting or to not just embrace the thing he really wanted to do. And eventually this leads him to meeting someone who, while she doesn't count, she draws, and she draws patterns. And there is this incredible moment when they recognize how this connects them. And, you know, there's a friendship blossoms. Mm-hmm. So that was the idea behind the story. And I happen to know that this kindergarten boy is leaving in about a week to go off to get a degree in math.
Wow. That was a while ago.
Yeah, it took a long time. 13 years from the origin, the original idea to publication, which I have to say is a Fibonacci number. So that's quite satisfying.
Yes, indeed. And what was the one word? We have to know the one word that you chose for the first word.
Yeah, the first word is Leo. The main character's name. But let me tell you, it took several years to get to that first word.
Yeah, you know, people have this idea that children's books must be easy to write because they're short, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Sarah and Ian, will you talk about your first book and how you came to write it? And I guess I should tell the listeners that you are a married couple, so you write together, and you might want to just describe that process as well.
Sure.
You want to take the book and I'll take the writing process?
Okay.
Okay.
Our first book was inspired by our home, our family. Our son Sam was a little boy who liked all things pink and sparkly and feminine. Starting from the time he was two, he wanted to have long hair and wear the pink princess dress-up costume at school and have sparkly shoes. And when he was three, he asked if he could wear a dress for real, a dress he could wear to school and out in the world. And we were supportive, but we were also wary about what Sam would experience from other kids and people out in the world. And we looked around for books that could help us guide Sam and books that could help Sam feel comfortable being himself. And there were no books. And so we decided we needed to write one.
Right. So Sarah thinks fast and big picture, and I think very slowly and in very detail oriented, which are excellent complementary skills, but make it difficult for us to sit next to each other and work, because Sarah will throw out an idea and I'll stop and I'll think about it. And I'll still be thinking about it. And she'll look over at me and say, "Are you here?" You know, I can see how it's frustrating for her. In the meantime, she's throwing out ideas very fast and it's frustrating for me. So we've learned that one of us, we talk about what we're going to work on, and then one of us starts it and gets it to a certain point where it's really ugly. And then we hand it over to the other one who edits it and then hands it back to the first person. And we pass our stuff back and forth like that until it's ready to send to the editor. And then it goes through the editing process where that all starts all over again. But that's how we work together on pretty much everything.
And so how old was your child once it was finally published?
It was published in 2014, is that right?
Yeah.
So he was 12 when it came out.
Uh-huh. And you use the pronoun he, so I'm assuming he identifies as male still?
He does. And
yes.
Interestingly, he always did. Oh. And we were always looking for if he wanted to use different pronouns. And he was really clear that he was a boy who wanted to wear a dress.
In a way, you know, representation can get really specific when it comes down to the actual book, because most people would assume that your book is about a transgender child, but not necessarily. It could be about a child, a boy who just likes dresses.
That's right. And we do hear that a lot. And we talk to parents and teachers a lot about how we don't know who kids are going to be when they grow up, when they're teenagers, or even tomorrow. And that our job is just to hold space to let them be who they are today so that they can feel confident in who they are today and that they will figure it out. And then trailing them, we will eventually figure it out.
Yes. And so, you know, it's interesting because what you are showing, the two different representations that we're talking about here, one might be a trait that follows a person through his whole life. Leo is probably someone, you said that he's going off to study math, right?
Right.
And so this is a trait that's going to follow him, whereas other types of representation are perhaps traits just that a child has at a certain time. Like one of my children walked on his tippy toes for a couple of years. And I was told over and over by preschool teachers, oh, you need to have that child, looked at because it might be autism. And I'm like, I think my kid likes to walk on his tippy toes. So, and in fact, that was it. He liked to walk on his tippy toes. So that's an interesting thing that, you know, I hadn't really thought about with representation, that it's not just fixed traits, because, you know, the obvious thing when you talk about representation in children's books that people are going to think of is race, right? Because that's been what's in the news mostly, is the idea of having a more representative color range and cultural range in our children's books, because previous to this century, amazingly, there wasn't much representation at all.
That's a good point, that certain aspects of identity are fixed and certain ones are not fixed. And it kind of doesn't matter because, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things we've heard from our critics about children who don't conform to gender norms is that it's just a phase. And I think it's really dismissive language because whether it is a phase or not, whether it's walking on tippy toes or permanently being a math person or something in between, it doesn't really matter because what matters is supporting that kid right now with who they are. Mm-hmm. And I think part of this is about what I was referring to earlier, that we as parents want to know. We want to know what's going to happen. We want to know who our kids are going to be. And so we tend to say to concerned parents, you know, you don't know if your kid's going to grow up to be an artist or a lawyer. You just don't know the future. And the point is just loving them up for who they are right now, regardless of if this lasts an hour or 100 years.
Mm-hmm. And so in the case of representation, why does it matter for kids who are literally going through a phase to see themselves in a book? Why is that as important as a kid's gender identity or race or culture?
Children live in a really circumscribed world. I mean, they don't see much outside of their families. And then when they get to school, the kids around them at school or the kids in their neighborhood, it's really like a very, very small world when you think about it. So if you're different in any way than the world around you, there's nobody else like you. There's no idea of like what you can be in the future. And when you turn on the television or open a book, in our case, the idea that you can open a book and see somebody who's like you, then there's like, oh, I'm not alone in the world. There's nothing strange about me. I'm just a way to be a person. And that's good for the kids who don't see themselves as represented in the world around them. And it's also good for the kids who do see themselves represented in the world around them to open a book and see a kid who doesn't look like them or anybody else that they know and say, oh, there's all sorts of ways to be a person. Mm-hmm. And I think it gets back to what Sarah said, you know, parents want the best for their children. And I think that's pretty much true across the board. And they're worried about what their kids are going to be like, especially if the kids are something that they're not familiar with. If you're not a math person and your kid is a math person, like, what does that mean? What are they going to do in the world? So you want to open up the possibilities for what math people do and see representations of math people out in the world. I mean, that's to take it away from, I think math's a safer thing to talk about than race or gender at this mm-hmm. point. So it's a good example to use. Like, we're not scared of math kids.
Although, you know, it is interesting. I want to bounce this back to Monica in a second, but it is interesting that having raised two really, well, one classic sort of little professor type of kid, I will tell you that there is huge, huge stigma against kids like that. So that people don't acknowledge. And so it makes it even harder because it's like this secret. You don't talk, people don't talk about it, but it's there and the kids know it. You know, they can sense that the people think there's something wrong with them. And so, you know, Monica, you know, can you talk a little bit about the importance of a kid like that boy seeing himself, but also the importance of other children seeing him in that book?
Yeah. I mean, I do see that I'm glad I have math as a kind of jumping off point, because that does feel like a safer jumping off point for talking about this book. But, I think that, in fact, there's all different ways to read what's going on for Leo. So I would say that when my publisher read the text, she thought, oh, this kid's on the spectrum, and I would really like to have more neurodiversity in my books. Mm-hmm. So let's go for this. Someone else read it to me and said, oh, yeah, this is my kid. He's obsessive compulsive. And, you know, so I think that it's very important to me, I think, when you write, to be both specific, but allow for a universality to happen. And so in this case, you never know what a kid will respond to. And when I think about the books that I read as a kid, I'm kind of startled at what were the most important books to me, because I would grasp something very little that would feel like me, but might not look externally like what a teacher would say, oh, this is a book for Monica. This is a little girl just like Monica. Because she didn't really know what was going on inside for me and how I felt different from everyone else.
So I wanted to ask you, you know, what is a book or books that really spoke to you as a child? And Monica, I'll ask you to start, since you brought up this idea that a teacher wouldn't have known what was going to speak to you. So what's a book that really spoke to you?
Yeah, that's right. So you asked this question before we came on, so I got to think about it a little, which was really interesting. And I realized that Ferdinand the Bull was one of my favorites. And so clearly I related to a bull. Ferdinand, and I think all of my writing seems to come from Ferdinand, who was a bull who wanted to sit just quietly and smell the flowers. And his mother, who was a very loving mother, even though she was just a cow, I think it says something like that in the text, supported him. And this book was banned by Spain, by Germany. It was hugely reviled by many different people for many different reasons. It was accused of being communist propaganda, fascist propaganda. It was accused of making fun of the peace movement. Like, it got bombarded from all sides. So clearly it was tapping into something. And for me, as a child, what it was tapping into was this idea that you could be different from everyone around you, and that you could embrace that. And if you continued to embrace it, stubbornly embrace it, eventually the people in the bull ring who wanted you to fight in that particular way would realize that was not for you and let you return to your field and continue smelling the flowers.
Well, that was beautifully said. I love that.
Yes, indeed. I and it just sparked all sorts of memories in me about books that I loved. But I'm going to ask you, Sarah, to go next.
A very different book stands out to me from my childhood. I really loved the book, Where Did I Come From? Where Do I Come From or Where Did I Come From? Published in the early 70s. It was basically a sex manual. And the only thing I can think to explain why I was so enchanted with that book is I really like to know how things work. Simple drawings and explanations work well for me. But I also think about the books that have been really meaningful to our family. And one of the books that we read endlessly to our kids, and I don't just mean we read it to our kids when it was age appropriate, but our daughter brought this book into school every year from kindergarten through seventh grade, I think. You know, it got to like book reports by the time she was older, but and analysis, but the book Entango Makes Three. And I still cannot read that book without crying. That is just, it's like a family banner or crest or something, you know, something of great meaning to our family. Uh-huh. Yep.
And how about you, Ian?
Well, my mom gave me Ferdinand the Bold because she could see that her non-athletic child was just like Ferdinand and just wanted to sit and read. My take on it's a little different than yours, Monica. In that, like, I don't think he stubbornly sticks to his guns. I think he gets lucky. They prod him until he actually does do something in the bull ring, and then they think he's so fierce that they honor him and let him go. And then he gets to sit and read the flowers. He sits and smells the flowers in the fields at the end.
I think that's my childhood analysis of it. And you're giving one of those more complicated adult analyses, which is fantastic. And I'm sure there's a lot of different ways to read Ferdinand the Bull that would be problematic or not.
That's the way I thought of it as a child. Like, wow, I hope I get lucky like that and people leave me alone. And the other book that I dearly loved was Go Dog Go, which I don't think has a plot at all, actually. It's all these dogs running around in cars and stuff. But they go to a party in a treehouse. Like, who doesn't want to do that? They sleep on a houseboat. It was just like the most best things you could possibly imagine doing as a kid. And the dogs get to do them.
Yeah, and do you like my hat?
Yes,
indeed. I do like that hat. That's the climactic point in the story when finally the male dog likes the female dog's hat. And they go off and you see them driving up. Obviously, I've read this book a few times. and I just listening to all of us talking about these books, it's just so clear how books affect children. So my next question is, imagine any child picks up one of your books, how do you want them to be affected? How do you want it to relate to them?
That's a great question. We write the kind of children's books that I didn't ever imagine we would write, in that they're kind of realistic. And they're set in real places, and they're not, you know, magical or fantastical or poetic in a particular way that I thought would be the kind of books that we would write. And we found that so they take place in a classroom or they take place in a home. They have adults in them. The children don't solve all their own problems the way they're supposed to in children's books. Teachers and the rest of the community get involved. We want children to relate to our books as though they're part of real life, because what we saw was that for people like our son, there were no books like him, and there was no way for him to be himself in that community that he lived in. And so we wanted to create a community and introduce a character like him into it, and show realistically the kinds of tensions that happen when you know, a little boy wants to wear a dress. What do the parents think? What do the teachers think? What do the kids in school think? And have it be okay in the end, but not have everybody agree about, you know, everyone doesn't hold hands and is friends at the end.
You raise such an interesting point about your books, that the book industry does really want the children to solve the problems without adults. And did you have to fight about that with your editors?
I know it was a conversation, but we have strong teacher characters, and that's useful both for serving as a guide to teachers, sort of as a classroom guide on how to handle situations. And kids relate to teachers as being important in their lives. And so once the editors saw that teachers were involved in the situation in a particular way, that was an okay thing.
And we'd learned so much from, in particular, our son's kindergarten teacher, that we wanted to be able to pass on these messages. And in fact, the teacher character in the second and third books, Ms. Reeves, is actually, that's her actual name. We tried to do that in the first book, but it got changed in the editorial process. But she was so extraordinary at teaching the kids in really simple ways that our son was okay just as he was. And she had no guidebook. There were no lesson plans at the time to lead her. And she just intuitively did it. So she would use these really simple lessons like, let's talk about colors. So are there boy colors and girl colors, or are there just colors? And, you know, of course, she'd spread this out over a period of time and get them talking about colors and questioning their own assumptions. And by the end of, you know, a 10 or 15 minute discussion, they would say, oh, colors are for everyone. And she did a similar one about hair by bringing in a photo of a little kid with short hair. And she said to the kids, is this a boy or a girl? And all the kids said, well, that's a boy. And she said, actually, that was me when I was in second grade. And they were like, no way. And then they look around and they realize our son Sam is sitting there with his long hair. And so by the end of 10 or 15 minutes, she could say to them, so sometimes boys have long hair and sometimes girls have long hair. Okay, no big deal. And what we didn't realize is that she was accidentally running this science experiment, because the kindergarten class next door didn't do these same lessons. And so at recess and lunchtime and after school, the kids who teased Sam came from the other class. And our class was just used to him. And we realized, oh my God, that's actually all it takes, is just really simple conversations questioning the assumptions that society gives these kids. And the kids are really open.
Yeah, kids learn really quickly. I mean, that's their job. It's the parents who struggle.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, Monica. I thought that was a really beautiful part of your book. Just, yeah, I noticed that it was breaking that rule, you know, in quotes, as a teacher of creative writing. I never want to say there's really rules, but, you know, where it's a teacher who comes in, but her lessons are so wonderful and so convincing that as a method for letting kids figure something out on their own about acceptance. Thought it was really successful. I'm actually coming at it from the exact opposite. In fact, in both of my books, what I'm interested in doing is, and you know, with the understanding that I think books like yours, we need those realistic books where kids say, that's me, or that's how to approach this problem. I also think it's really important that we have representation that's not right on the nose. So I wanted to have this kid, Leo, who's doing his thing because of what he's like, but it's in a story about friendship. You know, so it's not saying, look at Leo and how he is this way. Look at how Leo makes a friend. And so I think it's kind of open in terms of what kids see in it. And so you were asking, Suki, you know, what we would hope kids would see. I'm really excited to see what kids see. You know, I feel that kids are going to see whatever they see. And I've been able to read it a few times to groups of children. And I've been so amazed to see how engrossed they are in the friendship story. You know, some of them will come up to me afterwards and talk about the math, but the majority are like, oh, you know, they can kind of see it coming. Oh, Leo, he's going to meet Leah, because you could see Leah on the playground. And, you know, you can kind of, if you're paying attention, realize that's where it's going. Or if you look at the cover, obviously, on the title. So I'm just really excited to see what happens when kids, all kinds of kids, read it and find very different things in it.
Yeah. And kids books, you know, what we were talking about earlier, especially with you talking about Ferdinand and all of the various interpretations of that book, kids books are often open like that and open to kids finding things in them. And you don't know what those things will be. which is a wonderful thing about kids and books. In the digital age, when kids have lots of things to take up their time that we didn't have when we were young, but books are still very popular, especially with the ages that you all are writing for. What do you think is a special place that books have in children's lives?
I think that books take place on family time. You read a book at the rhythm of the parent reading it to the child. And you read to your child at the pace you think they're going to understand what's going on. And you stop, or they stop and ask questions or point to things on pages. And you sort of digest it in a particular way. And then each time you do it, it's very intimate. And it changes each time, depending on the other circumstances that are going on. And as parents, you know, your kids develop favorite books that they're going to want to read hundreds of times, just to, like, there's something soothing about it or exciting about it. So that pace is so different than anything that you experience on television or in a movie or in a video game even, because that's somebody else's scripted time.
And likewise at school, teachers are reading during quiet time, circle time, sometimes it's a one-on-one or a small group activity. And so I think whether it's home or school or a bookstore, books feel nurturing. And so there's something sort of full of love about reading time, regardless of what we're reading.
Yeah. And I feel like I keep returning to this idea of kind of randomness and not being able to predict what a kid will inspire a child. Books have this quality where we can pick them up randomly. If you walk into a bookstore, there's all these books and who knows what they're going to grab. And they can open to a page and return to it over and over if they want. There's also a lot of research into the difference between reading on paper versus on a computer, and how, I mean, our brains did not originally read. Reading is a very late development in our evolution. And so, you know, when we're reading, we're actually using different parts of our brain, both language and motor skills. And so maybe this is why when we hold a book and can feel it physically there, and we can see where we've come from and where we're going as we read, we absorb and retain books differently. And so having those physical objects around for kids to interact with and love and keep, you know, mm-hmm. I have some of my childhood books, and it's incredible to open those books and experience in the same way what I experienced when I read them as a kid or didn't. Mm-hmm. I'll see very different things sometimes too, yeah. And be amazed that that's not what I picked up on as a kid.
Yeah, you're reminding me of this research that I read and a situation where I related it to a parent. Somebody did research on the educational attainment of kids and how many books were visible in their childhood home. And no matter how little or much education the parents had, their children went on to higher educational achievement if there were visible books in the room. And this mom I was telling this to says, "Does it matter that we have 1,000 books on the Kindle?" And I was like, "No." No, it's, you know, the physical thing is also, and especially for picture books, you know, what you guys write, you know, when you have the book out there in the world, and we're talking about representation, that's also the physical book. Can you both talk about, all of you talk about how you feel about the art that ended up in your book? And you know, first of all, whether you had any say in it, and secondly, how you feel about how the children were represented and how that affects you seeing the characters in your head being turned by an artist who's not you into characters on the page.
We have a funny story about that, actually. The first illustrator who was hired to do Jacob's New Dress told the publisher that he was having trouble. He was struggling because he couldn't do this without it being humorous. I mean, just the very idea in a boy in a dress was funny to him. And he was like trying to figure out how he was going to make that work. And thankfully, our publisher fired him and hired somebody else. And the next person, Chris Case, had one question for us. He said, what does the dress look like? He's like, is it fancy? Is it like a princess dress? Could you like just send me some images of some dresses that would be appropriate? And we sent some images of dresses that would be appropriate. And we love his artwork. It's just amazing. And it's such a pleasure to see the kinds of stories he's telling in the background that, you know, aren't written in the story, and how he represents the people and how he imagines them. And
as the years have gone on, we've had more interaction with him, which our publisher has encouraged. And to the point where in the last book, some of our words were rewritten. We rewrote them with our editor based on Chris's drawings. And so it's become much more interactive and lovely. And we have a tremendous relationship with Chris that we really value.
That's really cool that you've gotten to work with the same person. That's a really special relationship.
Yeah, I mean, the received wisdom is that you don't interact with the illustrator at all, and that seems so mysterious to people. And that was the case up to a certain point with Kennard Pack, is the illustrator for my book. And I was very excited. I did have a choice, and I was very excited when the publisher suggested him. I wasn't familiar with his work, but I went to go read a book that he'd illustrated, and I had this incredible sensation that not only did I love his art, but that he was going to like my book. And indeed he did. So I had that, you know, some kind of feeling about it. So, but then I had this really excruciatingly long wait for him to start. And then there was a long pause where he had difficulty doing something that worked. And I didn't get to see any of those attempts. The publisher kept saying, not yet, not yet. And I think what was happening is that he was trying to figure out how to show the Fibonacci sequence in the illustrations without being too obvious, because my story itself is not obvious. It's not prescriptive in any way. It's not explaining the Fibonacci sequence. And ultimately, I was astounded when I saw the illustrations, because he'd created kind of this mysterious natural world. And that was really what I was trying to convey, that we are connected to the universe in this mysterious way that we all understand in slightly different ways. I should also say that, you know, I'm white and Kennard Pack is Korean American. And I was very excited to think that probably Leo would be a little Korean American boy, because in fact, I grew up in a mixed race family because my brother is adopted. He's Korean American. So it was kind of incredible. I didn't know what Kennard Pack would do, but it's kind of incredible to get the book and see Leo. And also, it was really important to me and to Ken that it be a really diverse classroom, because I didn't want to create a situation where Leo was the only Asian kid in a white class and that was his difference. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's that this is the world. The world is racially diverse. And Leo is Leo. He's a kid who counts. And that's his defining characteristic. So that's what happened. And it's a very strange feeling to get a book that's been illustrated by someone else. It took me a while, you know, 24 hours to kind of absorb this world I was being presented that was not the one in my head. But now it just feels that he expanded my world exponentially. So mm-hmm. it's an incredible art form for collaboration that way.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, children's literature is not supposed to necessarily represent a real world. Even books like, you know, Sarah and Ian, the way you describe your books is that they were much more realistic than you would have thought yourself writing. but they're never truly realistic because they are also supposed to show children a world we want. And one of the things that I was thinking about, Monica, when you were talking, was that statistically speaking, our schools are more racially segregated than ever now. That very few people are growing up in racially diverse classrooms. What's the importance of the representation of a classroom that probably doesn't look like most kids' classrooms?
That's really fascinating. I did think a lot about that as we were going through this process, because I am a product of the exact same generation as Kamala Harris in the Berkeley Public Unified School District. I grew up on a playground in Berkeley where everyone was being bused because we believed in mixing kids up. And I'm a product of Sesame Street. And when I look at all of the books from those early days, they were purposely very, very aspirationally mixed. And my kids have grown up in the Berkeley Public Schools, and these classrooms have been very diverse. And so I'm in a Berkeley bubble. So in a way, I was writing a book that reflected the classrooms my kids were in. So when I got the illustrations back and it was kind of, I don't know, suburban East Coast somewhere, I thought, well, I don't really know what those classrooms look like. But you know, if the illustrator is setting it there, great. I don't mind spreading that message of, I want to spread that message of our classrooms should look like this. But I don't know how that reads to kids. I hope it reads as, right, this is looks like the world. And that they won't think, ooh, this is not what my classroom looks like, or they'll think, I wish my classroom looked like this, but not, this is unrealistic and the author was trying to send a message. Because though we may have been trying to some degree, it's also a world that makes sense to me.
And is there a problem with sending a message? Because don't every choice that's made with children's books sends a message, right? Isn't that the point of children's books in a sense?
Yes, absolutely. And at the same time, it's not about prescriptive sending of messages, I don't think. Not if it's as successful as a piece of art. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more subtle than that.
Mm-hmm. And no one book should be expected to carry the weight of every children's book.
That's right.
There's supposed to be a whole bunch of them out there. Uh-huh. It's funny, your question strikes me as very California-centric in a way, in that I grew up in Syracuse, New York. And if you're from Syracuse, you never see yourself represented in the media. There are no television shows set in upstate New York. There are no movies filmed in upstate New York. There's no books that are set there. Well, there are a couple now. But so we watched things that all were filmed in California. And we watched people who didn't look like us. And we were aware that there was another world out there because of what we saw and read. So it doesn't seem strange to me that we would create classrooms that are unlike classrooms, you know, that I grew up in.
Uh-huh. My experience is more like Monica's, because I grew up in LA in public schools where there was a great deal of diversity. But then, as Ian brings up, everything on TV was set in my world. And it took me going to college in a small town in Massachusetts before I understood that the whole world wasn't Los Angeles, which is embarrassing to admit, but here we are.
I think Sarah's biggest shock was discovering that you couldn't valet park there.
Yeah, I grew up in a small town Midwest. And so you mentioned Sesame Street. And to me, where my question came from is how important it was to me as a little kid watching Sesame Street, and also that A Snowy Day was just one of my favorite books ever. And A Snowy Day is not, the text is not about a black kid. It's just about a kid, but the pictures were there and they just made it very clear. This is a kid. And to me, as growing up in sort of a very Michigan-specific situation, a state with a huge Black population, but that was very segregated. That you know, I saw that, and it never hit me as a kid that there was anything wrong about it being aspirational. In a sense, it gave me the aspiration not to spend the rest of my life only being around people who had the same, you know, set of characteristics as me. So you know, it's just an interesting thing to me that our culture is sort of, you know, when you look at the numbers, it's just fascinating that we've gone so far backwards in diversity in schools. It's just shocking. So yeah, so when somebody said aspirational, that you know, children's books are presenting a world, even when they're presenting an issue, like a boy being teased for wearing a dress, they're presenting the world that we hope that he will meet, which is the teacher who understands him.
It's interesting because we dealt with making it entirely aspirational in our first book. You know, do we have to have conflict? I didn't want to bring conflict in. And Ian said, the world isn't ready to not have conflict. We have to, I mean, obviously every picture book needs a conflict, but it doesn't have to be over what the kid is wearing. And we realize, you know, in time, we hope that this book becomes completely outdated, that people go, well, what's the problem? Why'd they bother writing this?
Yeah, we thought it was going to be quaint in 25 years.
Which, you know,
we were wrong.
Is aspirational.
It is.
But yeah, and you know, we are getting there. In our fourth book, we're going to not talk about it for the most part. We're going to talk about an entirely different topic and just have our main character, the boy in the dress, and his best friend, the girl in pants, and not address it. So, but we did have to lay that foundation, and many more books had to come out before we could have that book in the world.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, just speaking specifically about gender, it's really interesting to me, having followed this closely because of my own family, seeing what has happened, because I think it's really easy for us to forget how quickly everything changes. And there was a brief period where trans kids were given a lot of sympathetic press. And then this thing happened.
This backlash.
Yeah, the backlash. And so, you know, we're in the middle of the backlash as we speak right now, and you two can probably speak about that, and let's move to that in a second. But I want to point out that when I got married in 1998, a close friend of mine was a letterpress printer, and when I asked her to do our wedding invitations, she said she was going to make an exception because she said, generally, I refuse to do them because I can't get married to the woman I love. Mm-hmm. So, and she was the first person who ever mentioned marriage equality to me. So I was 98. And then here we are, it's really not that much longer that suddenly things really flipped. And we hope it stays that way. but so let's talk about your book and gender and what you have experienced, just putting this boy out there, not even making any claims to his gender identity, just that he wears a dress. How do adults react to that in a way that surprises you, upsets you?
Can I take the personal side of that and then you do the context? So when I used to write for adults, before we got into writing children's books together, Ian was a children's book author and I was writing for adults. And the reason we use pen names today is that after I published the first article I ever wrote under my real name, the kind of vitriol that we received was stunning. And we realized that it was not safe to write under our real names. We had small children at home. You know, I would say the vast majority of responses that we got from the world were positive. And yet there was a significant number of people who felt comfortable reaching out to tell us that we were child abusers, that We should have our children taken away from us, that we deserve to die, and so many more different sorts of elaborations on those themes. And so we decided we needed to protect our family. In addition to the just the fact that this was our son's, the book is fiction, but that it was inspired by his story, and that if he's going to speak publicly about that, it needs to be his story, not ours. So that was our other motivation. We were a little shocked by how angry and aggressive some of the opposition was. And then we've seen lots of that with our book getting banned, and most recently, the lawsuit one?
I have to say, when Jacob's New Dress came out in 2014, most of the response we got was positive, and the reviews were very positive. We get lots of pictures from parents with their little boys in dresses holding the book. It was so heartwarming, I cannot begin to tell you. And it was like a year or two before the first time it got challenged in a school. And then it seemed like an anomaly, just kind of a blip. And then another 2 years went by before it got challenged in a bigger school district. And then things just went crazy after that. So, of that list of 800 books in Texas that are, suspicious and need to be vetted, we've got two books on the list. Wow. Which makes me wonder if they haven't read our third book.
that your timeline overlaps mine perfectly. When I was talking about there was this period of relative support, and I found it curious and interesting. We were in the middle of it at that time, and then there was that wave. So, which two of your books, it is very interesting that the third one was not caught up in that.
Yeah. So there have been multiple lawsuits about teachers reading our books in classrooms. School districts have been sued, and they've come up with bizarre settlements where, like, teachers need their books approved a month in advance, and parents have to opt into the curriculum. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah. And especially because here, we're talking about books that represent how kids are, not books right. that nobody's worried that Monica's book is going to turn a little girl who loves to read and pick flowers into a little boy who likes math, right?
I assume, but I don't know. And I think there's always room for a book to be banned in this brave new world.
Yes.
And I do have another book coming out in February that I think might get some pushback. I don't know, but it's also very open. It's called Albert in the Air, and it's a boy who floats into the air at birth and keeps on floating. So you can read that however you want, but I'm sure there's someone out there who will be uncomfortable with what that metaphor might mean.
Yeah, I mean, geez, Monica, don't you know kids don't float? Setting a bad example for everyone.
Right.
So this has just been such a great conversation, and obviously we could just go on for hours, but we can't. So I wondered if each one of you could say a little bit about what you would want kids to experience when they pick up random books or hear their teacher or their parent read a book to them. What do you hope that they will get from the books that are going to be published?
Well, I hope that children get a sense of empowerment, but also mystery. I think we need both. We need a sense that we have some kind of control over our lives, and also an acceptance that we don't.
That's beautiful. I think it's a big, amazing world out there, and kids want to be exposed to it and learn more about it. And some of it is exciting and wonderful, and some of it is horrible and dark. And kids know that already. And Maurice Sendak actually talked about that a lot, as how he was a little kid. He knew all these terrible things, and he felt like he was protecting his parents from them. Kids are aware of that. And I think they want to see that in books, the whole range of things. And, in a way that's age appropriate. But that's what they want to know.
I realize I'm coming back to a theme that I think I've touched on a few times during this chat, but I realize that what I most hope for kids when they read our books, or really any book, is that they find that feeling of home, of coming home to themselves and feeling comfortable with who they are.
And that's a wonderful place to leave it, because all of the books that we've mentioned that inspired us being so different from what we were living in as children, we felt at home in those books. And even if they took place in far off lands or imaginary lands or in New York City, a place that I couldn't imagine being, it was home for us. So thank you. I want to thank all three of you, Monica Wesolowska and Sarah and Ian Hoffman. And I want to let listeners know that links to the books that we've discussed will be on the podcast page for this discussion. So please check them out. Thank you, all three of you, for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having us. This was lots of fun.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you.
It is great.
You've been listening to The Babblery, www.babblery.com.